It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. Over the weekend, Oconto County confirmed 9 cases of measles within its borders. Once a common childhood illness and then considered eliminated by vaccination, measles is a serious respiratory illness that causes rash and fever. States around the country have seen measles outbreaks this year. The cases in Oconto County are the first in Wisconsin in 2025. The state has a low rate of measles vaccination compared to most other states. According to the most recent data, there are over 1,300 confirmed cases of measles nationwide, already the highest annual number since the disease was declared eliminated in the U.S. in 2000. Kathleen Cooper of Rhinelander contracted measles at 6 years old. She shared some of her memories with us.
I had a high fever. My mother made me stay in a dark room because she said, like, bright lights while you have the measles could lead to blindness. And I was supposed to go to a birthday party that weekend. And I was sick, of course, couldn't go. And I remember all of the little girls at the birthday party came over to see me and came into my bedroom when I had the measles because their mother wanted to expose them so that they would get the measles and the mothers could get it over with. Because everybody, you know, got the childhood diseases in those days. So I had this big, you know, like all these kids in my bedroom, and they all caught the measles. And yeah, they used to call them measles parties.
3 deaths have been attributed to measles in the U.S. this year. The disease has an impact on the immune system, making people vulnerable to other infections. Now we turn to 2 health departments in northern Wisconsin to hear how local officials prepare for the potential spread of measles. Melissa Geach is health officer for the Iron County Health Department. Melissa, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And Tammy Boers is a health officer and director of the Forest County Health Department. Tammy, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for inviting us.
Tammy, let's start in Forest County. Now, we have a few confirmed cases of measles in the state, I think brought in by travel elsewhere. No widespread measles yet, of course. How do you prepare? How do you get ready for a potential spread in your communities?
So we do, each health department does have plans and policies in place to follow up on diseases. It's kind of similar to what we do every day with our follow-up on communicable diseases. And then we have been kind of amping up a little bit. We met yesterday with staff to just talk about possible what we're going to do if this happens in our county. And we have reached out to our healthcare providers, our schools, our Head Starts, our daycare providers, and just started having the conversations about if this happens, what's everyone's role. We also do have 2 tribes in our county that we also partner with and communicate with, and then really start doing outreach to the public on vaccination and the importance of that.
And Tammy, your Forest County shares some borders with Oconto County. Does that raise some extra red flags saying, hey, this is in our neighborhood?
It does, actually. I know that what we have heard is that it is, you know, a certain group of population based on travel that we're ill with Oconto. But with the school starting, we do want to prepare and make sure that children and parents are aware, or make sure that parents are aware that their child should be vaccinated for the MR. And we do have some Oconto residents that do live in the Wabino area and go to that school. So we are definitely trying to communicate and get information out to our school districts as well as to the public through Facebook, websites, press releases, things like that. So we really appreciate the opportunity to be on the radio today.
And Melissa, I last talked to you in March when measles was starting to spread in Texas and elsewhere. How have you been preparing over the course of this year as you're watching the news from other states and now from within Wisconsin?
Yes, well, it's always concerning when measles shows up so close. And we've done the same thing that Tammy does. We've met as a team and we've connected with our healthcare partners, our schools and daycares. We've trained for this. We have trained communicable disease investigation staff and with our close partners in infection control at hospitals. I think we're prepared for this if anything were to develop.
And Melissa, Iron County, as we talk about, is a rural area. What are some of the unique challenges that you and your colleagues in rural areas face when trying to watch for these diseases and react to them?
Well, just like in any case, measles has to be identified and diagnosed by a healthcare provider. So it's really important that if someone's having symptoms or they were at risk of being in contact with someone, is to connect with their healthcare provider. And healthcare providers are really the ones who report those illnesses to us. So that relationship is really important. In rural areas, we do have limited healthcare providers. People do have to travel quite far. We don't have a hospital in our area. So we connect with quite a few organizations, including in Ashland County, down in Vilas County, and north of the border over in Michigan.
We're talking about measles with two county health officials in northern Wisconsin after the first detection of the disease in Wisconsin this year amid a nationwide series of outbreaks. Tammy Boers is with us from Forest County, Melissa Geach from Iron County. Tammy, let's talk on a practical level. If you had that notice, okay, we have had a confirmed case of measles or cases of measles in our county, what does swinging into action look like? What do you do?
Well, it would definitely be all hands on deck. Similar to Melissa, we do have a small health department. Would be contacting the state. It would be reaching out to our healthcare providers. We do not have a hospital here either. So it would be making contacts to our local clinics and our tribal partners that do have clinics on site. And it would be getting information out there on how to stay safe, making sure that people are immunized if they are not up to date. And an important thing with measles is because it is so contagious that if people think they have symptoms, they should call their doctor or clinic and get guidance from them. Because it's contagious, we don't want people just to start showing up. And then we would start contact investigation of that person that was diagnosed to further stop the spread.
Yeah, and Melissa, what does that look like, trying to make sure that, okay, these people have had measles, we need to know who they've been in contact with, get the word out. What kind of things can we do once we have that infection to not keep spreading it?
Sure, those who are infectious should remain home and to prevent the spread. Much of our contact tracing includes contacting all those individuals who may have been in close contact. And with measles, since it's extremely contagious, we will even identify locations such as gas stations that they walked through or clinic rooms that they may have gone to, the grocery store, so that people can be aware that and watch for symptoms if they happen to be in that location while that infected person was there. We also do assess vaccination status. Vaccines are a preventable way to prevent measles, and so much of our contacts do have immunizations with measles, so they're likely not going to be infected. However, it's really important. This is a fast-paced process, and getting out the word is important.
And Tammy, a big part of the story here is we had measles basically down to zero in the United States with higher measles vaccination rates for a variety of reasons. People aren't getting as vaccinated as much, so there's a pool of people who are vulnerable. And of course, infants who are too young to get the vaccine are vulnerable themselves. What are you looking at when it comes to vaccination rates, Tammy, and how it makes us at risk of potential outbreaks?
So part of our process when we met yesterday was looking at our rates. And so far in Forest County, our rates for our schools are at 95% being vaccinated for measles. So we're good, especially when it comes to herd immunity. However, with that said, we still want to make sure that we're getting the message out to people that may not feel comfortable with getting their child immunized, how safe it is, and the importance, especially with measles, and like you said, with people that may have weak immune systems and infants that aren't able to have the vaccine, how important it is as a community to protect them. And when we did send out our message on Tuesday to our schools, we've already had people coming in to get their children up to date on vaccine. So our message so far is working, and hopefully, you know, everybody will get the word out and do what they can.
And Melissa, how about vaccination rates in Iron County?
I have not looked at recent vaccine rates. However, I do know that in the schools, we are in the 90s. The younger crowds entering school are at a lower level. And so it's really important that we're reaching those younger families and encouraging vaccines, since the vaccine is the single best prevention for measles.
And Melissa, when measles is in the news and we're seeing outbreaks in other states, do you get the sense that people's ears perk up? And if they'd been delaying on the vaccine, they're more prone to say, hey, maybe we should finally get this done?
I think so. I think we have to be willing to be there and listen to their what their thoughts are and answer their questions. I think many people are seeking reliable information to make good choices for their children. And just being here ready to ask their questions, yes, cases in Wisconsin will increase those questions among people who may have chosen to delay vaccines.
And Tammy, on a super practical note, if people are listening, what are the signs of measles they should be watching for themselves, their kids, where they say, yeah, I should make that call, report this, see if this could be measles?
So some of them are, it's kind of like a cold. So a fever, cough, runny nose, watery eyes, and then you get a red raised rash that typically develops from the head and then it goes down to the rest of the body.
And we'll leave it there. That's what to watch for. Tammy, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Melissa, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Melissa Geach is health officer for the Iron County Health Department, and Tammy Boers is health officer and director of the Forest County Health Department. Been talking about the detection of measles in Wisconsin, the first reported cases in the state this year, as other states have dealt with outbreaks. Coming up, a barrier is in the works to block the spread of invasive carp into the Great Lakes. We'll find out how the race against the clock is going.
They do threaten a $7 billion a year fishing industry and recreational industry on the Great Lakes.
That conversation is next here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. A project to prevent invasive carp from entering Wisconsin's Great Lakes via a choke point near Joliet, Illinois, has been in the works for years. In May, it finally got the go-ahead after being paused. The holdup came after the federal funding freeze nationwide led Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker to halt the project until the Trump administration confirmed they'd maintain their commitment to help pay for the $1.2 billion plan. The project at the Brandon Road Lock and Dam will use bubble curtains, electrical fields, and sound to keep the carp from the Illinois River out of Lake Michigan. Two state DNR officials join us now for a look at the project and keeping invasive carp out of Wisconsin waters. Amy Kretlow is the Aquatic Invasive Species Program Coordinator at the Wisconsin DNR, and Wade Strickland is Director of the DNR's Office of Great Waters. Wade, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
And Amy, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Amy, let's start with you. Before we get into the practicalities of keeping Asian carp out of the Great Lakes waterways, I want to talk about the why. We've been hearing about these guys for a long time. We have a lot of invasive species in the Great Lakes ecosystems. Why are we worried particularly about Asian carp?
Well, if Asian carp do get into the Great Lakes, they could really start to disrupt the food web in the Great Lakes. The carp that we're really worried about is our silver and bighead carp, which are filter feeders, and they do consume very large quantities of plankton. And plankton are the base of our aquatic food web, and they're with them being filter feeders, it could really reduce food availability for fish like yellow perch, lake whitefish, juvenile game fish, and alewives and bloaters.
Wade, this is a tale of two water systems, the Great Lakes and the Mississippi River. Wisconsin, of course, parts of it drain into each of those. And we have this man-made connection between the two. Can you talk about this artificial waterway and why this is now the front line in keeping the Asian carp from moving from the Mississippi, where it is and has gotten into the Great Lakes?
Yeah, the Illinois waterway has been constructed over 150 plus years, and it's been engineered so there was a connection from the Great Lakes down to the Mississippi River and vice versa. Right now, we've got invasive carp right around Joliet, Illinois. So the Brandon Road Lock and Dam is actually positioned in that area. And folks have been working really hard through overfishing, intentional overfishing of Asian carp to kind of keep them there while we work on the Brandon Road project.
Now, talk us through the Brandon Road project. I almost seems like a horror movie, and the monsters are coming, and we are trying to build this wall to keep them from breaking through. What is happening in this lock and dam?
Yeah, so it's about a $1.4 billion project. It's been in the works, under discussion and design and planning for about 10 years. And in that lock, the proposal is to include a bunch of different deterrents that would keep invasive carp from moving further towards the Great Lakes. Things like bubble curtains, acoustic deterrents, large engineered channels that we can put additional control measures on, and actually a flushing lock to keep the fish moving downstream.
Wade, what is a bubble curtain?
So a bubble curtain, if you can think of just bubbles coming out of an aquarium, think of it like that, but it's fixed. The main one we're kind of thinking about or talking about now is one that's fixed on the riverbed, and it bubbles up really large bubbles, and the fish try to swim through them, and they get frustrated, and they head back downstream. The other thing that it helps do is other aquatic invasive species that move upstream, those bubbles will actually detach them from the bottoms of the barges and have them discharged downstream as well.
Now, Amy, part of the story is watching and observation. What do you do as part of your job to watch for where Asian carp are in Wisconsin, whether that's where we're really worried about now, the Great Lakes Basin, or the waterways connected to the Mississippi Basin?
So in the Great Lakes, we do work collaboratively with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And each year, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service talks with Wisconsin, and we develop a monitoring plan that includes eDNA. And each year, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service does go out and they collect water samples in some of our major harbors, such as the Milwaukee Harbor and up in Green Bay. And we check for any kind of DNA from these silver or big head carp.
Wade, can you talk about the collaboration going on between different units and levels of government?
Yeah, so Wisconsin participates in something called the Great Lakes Commission. And the Great Lakes Commission has all of the 8 Great Lakes states sitting on it. And this topic, the Brandon Road Project, has been something that we've been talking about for 10, 15 years, really to kind of coalesce around an idea of what might work, where we might need to install these technologies, and how to get that funded. There's been a lot of work with the federal government to get funding secured. At one point, it was a 65 and 35 federal state cost share split, and we've gotten it up to 90-10 cost share split. And with the recent federal administration, there's been a memo that came out from the White House that has voiced support for this particular project. So that's been really great to see as well.
And Wade, that part of the story is huge. There's concern. A lot of the funding that people previously assumed was coming from the federal government was canceled or blocked or delayed for review, things like that. And I understand that led Illinois at one point to say, well, hold on, we don't know if we can proceed with this because we don't know if the cash is there. It seems like all parties at the table agree that the money is there and that all this stuff can go forward. Do I have that right?
Yeah, Illinois and Michigan have been the non-federal monetary sponsors. So they've each contributed $50 million for Illinois and $64 million for Michigan. And with those investments, they wanted some assurances from the federal government that the project would move forward. based on that request, the White House did produce that memo that said, we agree, we will fund this project. It's an important project to keep the Great Lakes free of invasive carp. So right now, all of that's looking really good.
Now, Wade, how close are the Asian carp to this Brandon Road lockdown? How close have they been detected?
So the general mass of invasive carp has not moved much past the Interstate 55 by Joliet, Illinois there. But, you know, we're talking 10, 15 miles away from the Great Lakes.
But Wade, even if it's a slow movement, how long is it going to take to have this stuff in place? Is there a concern that we might be too late to have these measures in place?
Certainly, that's a concern. Right now, based on some of the eDNA data that you heard Amy talking about, we don't have a concern that there's a reproducing population in the Great Lakes of those invasive carp. So time is of the essence. There's no doubt about it.
Amy, in the western part of Wisconsin where we have Asian carp, what are the borders now? How far have Asian carp moved from the Mississippi River inland into Wisconsin?
Actually, we just last year, our first reports of invasive carp in Wisconsin waters, and it was only on two of our tributaries, the Black River and the Chippewa River. And with those two rivers, they were found up to the first dam. So we're very fortunate to have a lot of these dams on our western side of the state to keep the invasive carp more on the Mississippi. But those are the only two real inland finds that we have discovered of invasive carp in Wisconsin waters.
So Wade, the timeline on this Brandon Road project, what's happening when?
Right now, we're actually at a really exciting juncture where there's two main increments. Increment one, which will add some of the large bubble curtains that we talked about earlier, and some of the acoustic speaker sound deterrents. And that increment is currently out for bids, with bids due back to the Army Corps of Engineers by August 28th of 2025. And so there will be some work done in that particular project, as well as some land acquisition work that the state of Illinois is working on with one of the utilities down there. That's actively ongoing. And then second, in the next couple of years, hope to finalize design and get funding and construction done for increment two. And that will add additional electrical deterrent barriers, a larger acoustic array, and a flushing lock. And that will hopefully occur in the next 2 to 5 years.
And finally, Amy, I know for some aquatic invasive species like mussels, we want people, if they're moving boats from one lake to another, well, to clean them up real good, make sure you're not letting them piggyback on your boat. Are there things that the public can do to help stop the spread of Asian carp or make sure they don't contribute to the spread of Asian carp, especially in those rivers in western Wisconsin where we had those first sightings last year?
Sure. Some really good deterrents is using bait from bait shops. The bait from a bait shop is all regulated bait that we know that is not invasive carp. Another thing is always empty out your live wells with the water, just in case there could be some not only invasive carp, but any kind of other invasive species within that water. You want to always drain your boat and your live wells and always just make sure that there's no mud or plant material on your boat or your anchors or your trailer when you're removing it and going to another body of water. Another rule of thumb is usually try to, if you can, dry your equipment for a minimum of 5 days. That does get rid of not only invasive carp, but a lot of other invasive species that you wouldn't be transferring to another water body.
We'll leave it there. Amy, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Wade, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Rob.
Amy Kretlow is an Aquatic Invasive Species Program Coordinator at the Wisconsin DNR. Wade Strickland is Director of the Wisconsin DNR's Office of Great Waters. We talked to them about a $1.2 billion project to prevent invasive carp from entering Lake Michigan via the Illinois River and the state of invasive carp in Wisconsin waters. Now we'll hear from an environmental educator about the work she's doing with Wisconsin youth to detect invasive carp in our state's waters. Amy Workman is the director of the Upham Woods Outdoor Learning Center, which sits alongside the Wisconsin River north of the Wisconsin Dells. Amy, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks. I'm happy to be here.
Can you tell us about Upham Woods and the kind of work you do there in general before we dig into this this particular project?
Sure. Upham Woods Outdoor Learning Center is a residential program, which means that youth groups come and stay with us overnight. And so we have several different accommodations. We have cabins, we have a two-story dorm. And in the summertime, we also do an outpost camping program in tents for some groups. So it's all about connecting youth with positive outdoor experiences that are scaffolded so that they increase their level of skill and comfort and relationship with the outdoors and with each other over time.
When I think of outdoor activities for kids, you know, hiking and maybe orienteering, campfires, maybe tents, what I don't think about is genetic detective work in the waterways. What is going on with this environmental DNA hunt for these invasive carp?
Yeah, this project is really exciting and came about because, as you may know and your listeners may know, there was some invasive carp found below the Prairie du Sac Dam on the Wisconsin River way back in 2017. And so that raised the question of, are invasive carp found in other places in the Wisconsin River? And since we're located on the Wisconsin River, I thought this was an incredible way to engage youth in a really positive way where they're involved in the detective work of determining, or at least helping to determine, whether or not there's evidence of invasive carp in our section of the Wisconsin River.
All right. Now, if I'm a kid in this program, I'm a little old for it, but pretending, if I'm a kid in this program, what am I doing?
Sure. So first, you're learning about all the things we just talked about in terms of the impact of an invasive aquatic species on riverways and specifically invasive carp. But then what you do with that information is you take a kit, and we do this in six groups to six different locations that are along the Wisconsin River on Upham's campus. And the students actually collect a river sample, and then they filter it using an ultrafine microfiber filter paper. And then they cut up that paper into a tube that is a DNA extraction kit. And so the idea is all the cells that are shed from organisms in the Wisconsin River or that fall into the river are collected on that filter paper. Then the DNA extraction kit, they actually do the lab, which busts open all of those cells to release the DNA. That's the environmental DNA, is that it's that DNA that is in the environment, in this case, in water, that can be isolated. So they're collecting the samples, they're extracting the DNA from the cells that are captured in that filter paper. And then with all of the DNA mixed together from all of the different organisms, we are amplifying, and the students do this, we're amplifying just the DNA of interest, which in our case is our positive control, which is bluegill, because we know bluegill are in the Wisconsin River and we expect to find them. But then we also amplify, if present, two different species of aquatic invasive carp, and that is bighead and silver carp.
What has been the response from the young people doing this? It sounds like a lot of fun to me, as well as being educational.
It is, and that's kind of what we love about it, is that it is fun, but at the same time, they're learning so many things as they go. So one of our goals was to kind of expose the youth to the idea that science is a process. And so we have had students particularly say that, I'm so happy to be involved in a project that is real, that is not a cookie cutter lab where we know what the answer is because it's already been determined and the lab is set up such that we're trying to find kind of a predetermined answer. This is a big unknown. We don't know what we're going to find. And so it's really cool to have that real life mystery that we're helping to solve by engaging in this project.
If the students find, or the kids find, the bad news, they find that there's invasive carp DNA, do you report that to somebody then?
Oh, well, what we say when we make very, very clear to the youth that participate and the adults is that if we find evidence of invasive carp, that does not equal a right. live specimen of invasive carp in the Wisconsin River. It is one piece of evidence that then we can share such that the agencies that are involved in the mitigation And the control of invasive carp, like the DNR and like the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, can do further experiments and further tests to confirm whether or not that is the case. So this is like the early detection, early warning system that we can engage students in, knowing that we're doing this in an outdoor learning center environment where there is a possibility of contamination. But this is really important because what it does is it helps those agencies kind of direct their resources, their limited resources, in more targeted ways.
Now, whether we're talking about young people or grown-ups, what do you see as the value of citizen science, getting non-scientists involved in helping out with this kind of environmental research?
Oh, it's a great, great question. I think broadly for everybody, youth and adults, it's really important that people understand that science is a process. And as we learn more, as we get better evidence and better data, we come to better conclusions about all kinds of environmental challenges and problems. But the second thing that I'm really excited about is that there's just so much bad news about the environment. And so youth particularly are hearing stories about extreme weather events, flooding, heat-related illnesses, wildfires, forever chemicals, microplastics. There's just so much bad news out there that I think it's really important that we give youth positive experiences in that they're not helpless. You know, there are ways to positively engage in addressing and solving some of these environmental challenges, and that they can be part of the solution. They don't just have to hear about the problems and then feel anxiety or depression or helplessness about it. They can engage in positive ways that enable them to be part of the solution in addressing these problems.
Amy, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Amy Workman is director of the Upham Woods Outdoor Learning Center, which lies along the Wisconsin River north of the Wisconsin Dells. Talk to her about the work she's doing with Wisconsin youth to detect invasive carp in our state's waters. Earlier, we talked to DNR officials about the effort to keep invasive carp out of the Great Lakes. Still ahead, the Mitchell Park Domes are a landmark in Milwaukee, and after years of financial uncertainty, there's a plan in place to keep them open. We'll get the details.
It truly was a game changer for us. This project really isn't possible without the county's support, so we're really pleased to have them come in on this fashion.
That's next here on WPR News. You're listening to Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a young artist whose creative journey is just beginning.
When radio producer Alexandra Salmon first saw Sadella Yancey rap at a summer night concert in Madison, she was mesmerized by the musician's talent. She admired her stage presence as she performed the classic Diggable Planets song Rebirth of Slick, Cool Like That with her family. Salmon set out to meet Yancey to talk about what it's like to be a young artist.
My name is Sadella Yancey, and I am 10 years old.
So what I'm trying to understand is, because I have no musical talent at all, so I am amazed by people like you who do. And so I want to know what it is like when you are rapping and you're in the middle of that. How would you describe that experience?
I would describe that experience by like thinking of the things that first come to my head and just like making them make sense and putting like the words together that makes like a rhythm and makes it flow. We be the chocolates, tap some on raps. She innovates at the sweetest cat naps. He at the funk club with the vibrate. Them, they be crazy down with the fire plate.
Okay, so pace is a big part of it.
Yes. You have to, like, be able to not, like, stutter. And you have to make sure that you put, that you don't, like, make pauses in your words. Borders get loose. Hot to consume a baby just like juice. If it's a, then we'll lift it off the plastic, the babes will go splastic.
Wow, so you must be thinking pretty quick when you're rapping.
Yes, I do. A little too quick. cool like that, cool like that, cool like that, we out.
So is it different then from your normal sort of pace of how you think just throughout the day? I mean, does it feel faster when you're rapping?
Yes, way, way faster, because I'm a slow thinker when it comes to other things, but I have the song memorized, so it's like easier to remember it because I have it like jotted down in my brain, like it's on a replay.
What do you think that adults could maybe better understand about what it's like to be a young artist?
I feel like older people should understand that I don't really know how to make my own raps yet. Personally, it took me about like 3 weeks to memorize the rap that I did. So you can't just do a rap and then think that you can do like another one in like one day, because it takes a lot longer to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. Can you tell me about kind of how you are just in general and versus your stage presence?
When I'm on stage, I just feel an excitement, and it's nice because I sometimes get to go in the studio with my cousins and my uncles and my dad, and it just like makes me think like, this is how it's gonna be on stage. This is so cool. At first, when they were telling me about how many people were gonna be in the crowd when we were practicing in the studio, I was scared, but when I got up on stage, it was like a lot of people, like they loved me, and they were just like surprised because I came out of the back after my dad was done after his rap, and it was really cool, and I just felt like I could embrace myself. I'm cool like that, I'm young like
that, I'm smart like that, I'm chill like that. Alexandra Salmon brought us that conversation with artist Sedella Yancey of Madison. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is Wisconsin Today. After nearly a decade of debate, Milwaukee County signed off on a deal that would send $30 million to repair and redevelop the Mitchell Park Domes. The legislation was signed by Milwaukee County Executive David Crowley last Wednesday. The plan would transfer operations to the Milwaukee Domes Alliance, who would be on the hook for raising an extra $85 million to fund efforts to save the conservatory. Krista Beal-Diefenbach is CEO of the Milwaukee Domes Alliance. She talked with Wisconsin Today host Lee Rayburn last week.
Let's start about when you learned about the county stepping in to help with the funding for the Mitchell Park Domes, and what you felt when you found out the county would be signing off on this plan.
Yeah, so we have been working with Milwaukee County now for the better part of 2 years, really, walking through all the steps necessary to confirm this level of commitment. But on Wednesday, when it was official and the county executive joined in his endorsement of the plan, I mean, it truly was a game changer for us. This project really isn't possible without the county's support, and so we're really pleased to have them come in on this fashion.
The Mitchell Park Domes opened in 1965. What is it about this park that makes it so special, and why is it so important to you, Krista?
Well, I always say that this is the marrying of all of my great loves. So I am a mid-century architecture person. I actually owned a home that was designed by Donald Grebe, who's the architect for the domes. And I love plants. I have a ridiculous number of houseplants and outdoor gardens. And I really find that connection to nature really supports my own emotional and physical health. And having all of those things in one facility is, I think, very special. In terms of the domes for the broader public, I think that everybody has their own dome story. I have spent now 4 years talking to the community about why it is that they love the domes. And it really is like a family heirloom that's been passed from generation to generation.
So, Krista, what are some of the plans in this new agreement with Milwaukee County for the future of the Mitchell Park domes?
Yeah, so I think that one of the things that's important to note about this plan is that we're not just putting the domes back the way they were. We are going to address the deferred maintenance. We are going to upgrade all the mechanicals and do those pieces which are critical to the future of the domes. But we're also going to add many new amenities that really drive at this idea of a sustainable business model. And so if you think about, the county, and it does have these fiscal challenges, but this plan is a fiscally responsible plan. And that's because it does remove the domes from the county's list of obligations. You know, they are currently covering a deficit budget each year for the domes. But by adding all these great amenities, we're going to be able to drive more in admissions and drive more in admissions revenue and really be able to solve that equation on how do you create the sustainable business model so the domes has resources to put away for future maintenance needs.
Yeah, Krista, what are some of those new amenities and projects that are expected once this project is completed?
So yeah, we'll have an expanded gift shop. So, our current gift shop is quite small. It's mighty though, I'll tell you. We make a lot of money off of that small gift shop. And it's also important to our programming. So, we feature a lot of local artists and small businesses through our gift shop. And so being able to then expand that to twice the size is really going to be an important revenue stream for us. And it will be a better visitor experience. We're also going to add a cafe. So right now, you don't have the opportunity to, grab a sandwich or a cup of coffee at the domes. And so we'll have this boutique cafe, which will extend the amount of time people are able to enjoy the gardens. And then one of the other pieces we're going to do is add an interactive children's garden.
Ooh.
So we actually have four domes. Most people are familiar with the three that right. We have are open to the public. But we have what I call the secret fourth dome. So right now we use it as a growing greenhouse. And when we're moving plant material from one dome to the other, we use that fourth dome for that purpose. But it's perfectly situated and sized to be able to create this amazing kids garden. So we call it the Little Sprouts Dome. It's going to be able to be what, a yes space for kids. Right now, we're always ranked as one of the top family favorite activities in Milwaukee. However, we do have a lot of signs up that says, don't run, don't jump, don't climb. And especially don't touch the cactus. But this will be our yes space where kids can come and dig into their love of nature.
We're talking about a recently approved plan to restore and maintain the Mitchell Park Domes in Milwaukee with Krista Beal-Diefenbach, CEO of the Milwaukee Domes Alliance. And Krista, what's the timeline for these new efforts and installations at the domes?
So we're hoping to start construction as soon as 2027, 2028. That is predicated on our ability to shore up the rest of the financing. So as you mentioned, the county has committed $30 million. The first phase of this project, the total capital stack is $115 million. However, we are leveraging some creative financing that allows us to really bring in significant significant amounts of resources. That includes New Market tax credits, that includes historic tax credits, as well as a philanthropic campaign. And so once we have all of those pieces in place, we'll be able to kick off this project, and we will stay open. The domes will stay open during construction. Okay. So our community will have the opportunity to come in and see what we have going on. But, you know, we would be able to have a grand reopening, you know, as soon as 2030 or shortly after that.
One part of this approved plan says that if Milwaukee Domes Alliance fails to raise sufficient donor funds, the county would not release its share of the annual funding. Is your alliance on track to raise enough dollars to keep county funding coming in, Krista?
Yes, we are. And that, again, it includes the county has communicated that it's not just philanthropic contributions, but that includes all of those other that financing that I just mentioned.
Okay.
And so, you know, we are working our way through that process. So we're also entering into that, you know, the silent phase of a capital campaign. So we're meeting with our, you know, lead donors and asking about their interest in supporting this effort. And, you know, we've been planning on this for some time now and have put all the key pieces in place for us to be successful.
I have to ask you, Krista, the Trump administration's tax cuts and spending package signed into law last month cuts billions of dollars in spending for clean energy projects, and the Milwaukee Domes Alliance is looking to incorporate green infrastructure into the Mitchell Park domes. Are there concerns that certain tax credits for this project could be threatened or eliminated?
Certainly, some of the funding we were pursuing for phase one, but primarily for phase two, has been eliminated. So, you know, certainly I think that we're having to rethink our strategy when it comes to the second phase, which will add a new nature learning center into the park, as well as some outdoor gardens. For phase one, the tax credit programs are still intact in that in the budget that you had mentioned was approved. And so those programs still exist, and we still have access to them, which is wonderful. Certainly, you know, things have shifted and changed. We're going through a period of, I think, rapid evolution in our country. And it's requiring us to stay very nimble. But right now with that phase one, that capital stack has been safeguarded. So that's great news.
Krista, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me and for your interest in this project.
Krista Beal Diefenbach is CEO of the Milwaukee Domes Alliance. She talked to Lee Rayburn about a plan to renovate the Mitchell Park domes and keep them open after years of concerns that it might have to close. Yesterday on the show, I talked to three leaders at local newspapers and communities around Wisconsin. Next week, we'll dig into the role of local journalism and what happens when it's not available. And we want to hear from you with your answers to a few questions. Here they are. Do you subscribe to a newspaper in your community? If so, what does it mean to you to have that? Where do you go for coverage of local news? Not state or national, the stuff going on in your neck of the woods. Do you wish there was more local journalism where you live? Okay, those are the questions. Now it's your turn. Email your answers to wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org. You can also call us or text us. Either way, the number is 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232. Wisconsin Today producers include Mackenzie Crummy, Beatrice Lawrence, and Trevor Hook. Our technical directors are Sarah Hopeful and Lee Rayburn. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.